Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Welcome, LGM listeners. This is the first Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast that we have recorded and published for just a little while. You'll notice that we have new introductory music. This is accredited by Elizabeth Nelson, and it's a track from The Paranoid Style, and we hope you enjoy it, and we hope that you also enjoy all of her other music and that you buy it. So today, two LGMers, you may have noticed Game of Thrones is kind of a big deal at the blog. I'm Rob Farley, and I wrote a few things about Game of Thrones over at Slate. And with me is Steve Attawell, who has written a tremendous amount of material on A Song of Ice and Fire. How are you doing today, Steve?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I am well enough. You know, we are recording this in the wake of maybe we're past the wake now, but it is now several days after the final episode of Game of Thrones, and as much as the final episode, but also really the previous episode, which was called Bells. Sort of created a discussion on the blog, but also a discussion you were interested in, and I was interested in. It's kind of a meta discussion, right? But it's a discussion that you have phrased, sort of deconstruction or demolition. Exactly what was George R.R. Martin trying to do with this saga, sort of in reference to sort of broader tropes of medieval fantasy, right? Broader stories about medieval fantasy. And I know you've wrote a lot about this and thought a lot about this, so why don't you start by giving us some thoughts?
Sure. So I think this idea that, like, A Song of Ice and Fire is pure deconstruction. In a lot of cases, like, people go back to this one quote from George R. R. Martin, I believe initially... this was in a New York Times interview where he's sort of talking about, things that he liked and didn't like about Lord of the Rings. I mean, obviously, it was a huge influence on every single fantasy author. But he sort of talked about how, you know, what are Aragorn's tax policies? What does he do about the remaining orcs? Does he go on a genocide of orcs? And in broader terms, Martin was really kind of getting at this idea embedded in sort of the more medievalist aspects of fantasy that, you know, the good king is a good king because he's a good person. And, you know, what Martin was interested in, you know, throughout his series, he talks about the human heart at war with itself and where this applies to politics. What are the tensions between being a good ruler and a good person? I think as with any case where, you know, you're trying to divine the intent of an author, especially when, you know, the last two books are nominal, we don't know their content yet. There can be a tendency to take this too far. I think you see this a lot in the fandom with people who say, if you expect a happy ending, you're not paying attention, or that, you know, the whole point is to, like, be subversive and, you know, kind of realpolitik in the way that you view the world. And my idea of deconstruction is not demolition, is that, you know, if we approach deconstruction from, like, a literary theory perspective, the idea is that you are taking dominant tropes and ideas and subjecting them to heightened scrutiny and questioning. But you're not doing that ultimately to destroy them completely. You are sifting through them. You are looking for the sort of the pure, nuggets hidden inside the dross.
Well, I mean, you're taking it apart to see how it works, in a sense, right? I mean, that's kind of what's going on, right? And, you know, I mean, you're figuring out sort of what are the pieces in this that make it work, and in a sense, what we can say partially Martin's project here is, well, let's rearrange those pieces and see how they work differently when we put them in a different order.
Right, and you know, this is why I say, you know, you deconstruct to reconstruct. And I think kind of an interesting parallel here, a sort of a similarly iconoclastic writer is Alan Moore, because, you know, he followed up Watchmen, this famous deconstructive comic, with a series of what he called reconstructive comics. Top 10, Promethea, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, because he got a little bit sick of his own fandom. All these sort of people who read and loved Watchmen but didn't understand Watchmen and you know, were idolizing Rorschach and things like that. And so he wanted to do some reconstruction to sort of say, okay, now that I've sort of pared down what I think was, you know, unreflective or, you know, ornamental around the idea of heroism, what does it look like, you know, in a new state, right? If we, once we've stripped away all of that. And I think Martin is doing sort of a similar thing. You know, we were talking about before the show started that, like, there were some really strong Lord of the Rings, especially the kind of Return of the Kings elements to this last season.
Right. I mean, there are two moments that, I mean, well, so, yeah, you know, the final episode is not exactly, I mean, there aren't really any sort of scene by scene, but the echoes of especially Return of the King are quite remarkable. And this is something I put it on the blog, that the way that the Witch King of Angmar and the Night King pass are remarkably similar, right? You know, their final moments are extraordinarily similar. And I think, as you've pointed out, right, this appears to be Benioff and Weiss, right? Because we don't even have a Night King in the same way in the Martin, right? And so it's actually the showrunners who are echoing Tolkien here rather than Martin himself, even if he sort of has set up the universe in which they're making those echoes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think Martin is kind of also, I mean, this is my speculation. I've written about this a little bit on my Tumblr site. I think Martin is also going to be doing a bit of his own riff on Lord of the Rings. Like, I think there's going to be some similarities between what happens in Winterfell and the Battle at the Black Gate. You know, I had this whole theory that went viral shortly before it was disproven by episode 3 that, like, the dead in the Winterfell crypts were going to be Martin's spin on the Dead Men of Dunharrow. You know, I think, again, you know, like, if your idea is to do deconstruction, like, what better way to sort of take some of the classic beats of Lord of the Rings that, like, to be honest, fantasy authors have been drifting off, you know, ever since, but, like, put your own spin on it and give it its own meaning.
So, I think this comes up, for two reasons. I mean, so right now I think many of the rest of us are rewatching Deadwood, because the new Deadwood film, or the film will be coming out on May 31st. Right. So what if we, can we in a sense frame A Game of Thrones, now not A Song of Ice and Fire, and I think we need to come back to the distinction there, because I think you've written sort of very cleanly, but we'll talk about that, what the distinction between these two things. But, Game of Thrones is, in a sense, sort of really, it's an HBO series in the same way that The Wire and Sopranos and Deadwood are HBO series, and with sort of this this deconstructive aspect to them, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's the sort of the classic mafia story or the cops and robbers story in Baltimore the classic Western story, right? That, but in none of these cases is the deconstruction total, right? In the way it sort of has here, right? Even The Wire, which is in many ways kind of the bleakest of these, still has sort of romantic cop and robber aspects to it.
I mean,
right?
It's working and so within a lot of those sort of conventions of noir. Like, you know, the detective does not win completely by the end of the day, but they win a moral victory in certain places.
Right. And a lot of those places are sort of very notable to us because they are they remind us of pre-established notions and pre-established understandings of what we expect in a cops and robbers show, right? And in fact, they're even highlighted a little bit more because we see them so rarely, right? And the same thing could be said of Deadwood. The same thing could be said of you know, Sopranos, which is extremely referential to constantly referential to sort of the existence of this literature and this sort of romantic understanding of mobster life, right? And so, in that sense, and I don't think I'd ever really thought about it this way, right? In the tradition of HBO gritty reboots, right? Game of Thrones fits perfectly into that world, into that universe. So,
yeah, I think right down to this sort of issue of, you know, how far can you push the shocking death, right? I think this came up a lot also in Sopranos, that like that desire for a, you know, water cooler moment on Monday, sometimes pushing the story further than it can go, and you start to hit, a bunch of people have written about this, that like, Game of Thrones started to hit a point of diminishing returns, where a show that's composed entirely of sort of twists and shock deaths, like, pretty soon people get a little bit inured to that. You know, they have death pools, but, you know, they don't really kind of react as naturally, you know, as they once had. I think you can sort of almost, like, chart this with, like, people's reaction to the death of Ned Stark, people's reaction to the Red Wedding, you know, the Mountain and the Viper, and then it's sort of like slowly coasting down from there.
Right, and sort of many of the ways that people the things that people accept in classic high fantasy, what get framed in terms of the term here is plot armor, right? That people were using this a lot, right? Jon Snow again survived because of his plot armor. His plot armor is extremely effective, right?
Right. Arya got buildings dumped on her about a half dozen times, but
right,
she's got to be there for the final episode. So ...
Right. Although, and I think we'll get to this back in a little bit. It is kind of remarkable in the end, in sort of how the showrunners put it together, that by the end, neither the Night King nor Aegon Targaryen are actually at all that meaningful to how the story works out.
Yeah.
Right? For the show, right? That it's almost irrelevant. Jon's heritage is, which is the sort of the key riddle.
A lot of things.
It's almost irrelevant.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, pretty much all prophecy, foreshadowing, all of that stuff is irrelevant. The follow-up of, you know, a lot of dangling plot threads, not really relevant, etc.
So why don't we move now and talk a little bit about how you've characterized the distinction between Game of Thrones, which is the HBO show, and A Song of Ice and Fire, which is the book series, sort of why we have the title for the one and not the other, and then that maybe that can lead into at least a little bit of thinking about what our expectations would be for the last two books.
Sure. So this sort of, for me, came up in thinking about episodes 3 and 4, because, you know, I felt, as a lot of people did, that there was something really weird about having the final battle with this existential threat of the White Walkers be resolved at the midpoint, and then three more episodes devoted almost entirely into who won the Iron Throne. As I sort of said at the time, like, I think there's something significant about the fact that George R. R. Martin titled his entire series A Song of Ice and Fire, which sort of speaks to, like, ancient prophecy and these sort of dueling forces of, you know, supernatural power, and the fact that the HBO show called itself A Game of Thrones and ultimately was sort of more interested in the political story. You can find many quotes from Martin where he talks about the idea that the Game of Thrones is supposed to be a distraction. It's the thing that people are paying attention to instead of the real threat, something that he's analogized to things like climate change. I mean, most obviously with the idea of, like, winter is coming. But it works with any sort of, like, global existential crisis that no one's paying attention to. And this kind of gave rise, for me, to this theory that I think a lot of the events of season 8 we're seeing in reverse, that there is a final confrontation at King's Landing, and then the final battle with the Night's Watch, with the Army of the Dead. And, you know, to me, like, okay, even if we assume that a lot of the kind of plot beats are similar, at the very least, their sort of their context, their implication, their feel has to be changed enormously by the fact of that reversal. That, like, you know, for example, I argued that, like, Daenerys, you know, she's probably going to look into the abyss at King's Landing, but she can't take a swan dive into the abyss because she's got to go on from there and work with, you know, Jon Snow and all these other people to save the world. And that's got to put a different, you know, at the very least, a different sort of emotional valence to things.
Right. And I read your post on this, right? You also suggest that this is where we're really going to see the Fagon plot work out, the John Connington Fagon plot, where we won't have Queen Cersei, or at least not Queen Cersei in the same order, which was always sort of more emotionally satisfying than logically satisfying with respect to the show. But instead, it will be Fagon and Daenerys who are competing for the throne in the King's Landing plot.
Who's been given a much better nickname by the fans in the past couple of weeks, Young Grift, which I think is just like, initially it was a typo, but it works perfectly. So, you know, I think this comes down to like some of the perils and pitfalls of adaptation, which is, you know, largely for budget reasons to like focus on the cast they had, the showrunners decided to like excise certain plot lines. They pulled out Lady Stoneheart and gave a lot of her plot to Arya. They pulled out John Connington, Young Griff, who, you know, these are these, for those of you who haven't read the books, these exiles who are plotting to restore someone that they believe to be Rhaegar's, you know, lost son to the throne. And, you know, to me, this kind of, you know, and the idea is that he's going to come into conflict with Daenerys. And to me, this, like, is a really far more interesting conflict, you know, because Cersei is just such an obviously evil queen that a lot of the, like, internal dilemmas of, you know, Tyrion and Varys never really made much sense to me this season, because I was like, Cersei's an obvious bad actor. Like, there's no way of peacefully resolving this because she won't let it be peacefully resolved. Whereas, you know, the conflict with Young Grift, I think, is interesting because in some ways he's sort of biting Jon's style. He's like copying Jon's story, and you know, he fits the like classic fantasy archetype of the hidden prince who's, you know, secretly the rightful king, and, you know, he's going to ascend to his destiny. And like Daenerys is going to have a big problem with that because like she's going to see that as, you know, a sort of an existential threat to her. It's like, you know, she's the one who's like gone through all of this, you know, suffering and has this destiny. And now some dude is, you know, telling her to stand aside because he's a man. And, you know, he fits the story better.
And we get to play out this distinction here between sort of what we have thought her ends are, right?
Right.
I mean, she is not the same level of abolitionist in the books as she is. I mean, she is, but sort of not what how somebody framed it, abolitionist Hitler, right? Sort of her ideological foundations are slightly different in the book, but this, you know, what the Fagon or the Young Grift will give us is it will still allow us to see her as power hungry, qua power hungry, right?
That
you know, it won't just be about the Targaryen restoration, right?
I think it'll be, you know, it's maybe not power hungry as much as sort of insistent on destiny, that when you've gone so far and you've done so much, you have to believe that it has meaning, that it has purpose, and that when that meaning and that purpose are threatened, that's when people do horrible things. And, you know, so this is why, like, I thought, well, okay, you know, Martin has, like, clearly foreshadowed in some of his, like, advanced chapters that there's going to be another Dance of the Dragons. You know, what better way to kind of do this where, like, Daenerys thinks that he's a fake. She challenges him to ride a dragon because, you know, what happens when fakes try to ride dragons? They die. But, oh, he succeeds. And, like, in this moment, she decides to fight him to sort of have this duel on Dragonback. And that's what sets off the wildfire and sort of causes the, you know, still horrific destruction, still very much a war crime. But, like, there's a difference between.
Let's pause you there. I have a hammer. I have an issue. So, you know, as you know, and I'm sure you read them, right? I had the two Slate pieces, and then in the second one, I talked a little bit about sort of what the strategic logic for show Daenerys might have been for incinerating King's Landing. By the way, there's a amusement park in Ohio called King's Island that I'm going to take my daughters to this summer, and I'm now Burn incapable of calling it anything but King's Landing. Right, I just call it King's Landing all the time now. So,
okay.
Anyway, so I just wanted to make, and this is sort of more of, you know, a professional thing as well, right? When we talk about war crimes, we should actually talk about war crimes, right? Not simply unpleasant things that happen in war.
Yeah.
Now, what Danny did would clearly be a war crime under the existing statutes of law of armed conflict today, right now, right? What she did was not a war crime. It was an incredibly awful and morally repugnant thing, but it was not a war crime because there was no LOAC, or as far as we know, there was no meaningful LOAC that applies to her behaviors.
Over King's Landing. Even if you don't have the Geneva Conventions, right, you know, you can still go back to Llewellyn in Henry V calls the laws of war, these sort of more general customs about, you know, what can and can't be done. Because, you know, even in the Middle Ages, you know, there were attempts through ideas of the just peace and the truce of God and so on and so forth to, like, try to put some limits on armed conflict so that it wasn't this, like, Hobbesian war of all against all.
Right. So, I mean, there would be some aspects that would be reminiscent of customary international law, right, for example. Although, you know, why we should assume that an actor like Daenerys would be subject to those customs. I mean, we need a much more complicated story to be able, I think, to successfully use the term war crime in ways that we want to use it in this case. I mean, for us, it's easy now to say what's a war crime and what's not a war crime, right? Because we have customary, we also have LOAC, we have the Geneva Conventions, all of this stuff. It is much more difficult to sort of retrospectively impose these specific term war crime to the behaviors of pre-modern peoples and pre-LOAC peoples.
Mm. Sure.
Anyway, that's my hobby horse, and so we can move on from there.
Yeah, I guess the point that I was really more aiming at is, you know, there is, to me, a world of difference between, you know, a sort of a horrible accident that, you know, pushes a character to seek redemption and a conscious act of evil that really ends a character's possibility for redemption. You know, after that moment, Daenerys has to be kind of abolitionist Hitler because that's really the only direction they can go in. And this is a problem because, you know, if you paid attention to, like, any of the, you know, side note, truly, truly horrible, like, inside the episode interviews where it's just like some of the worst explanations of any of this, you find out
it's
that
just,
like,
shut up. No, just shut up. Just stop talking about your show because you're getting it wrong. Right.
Yeah,
I mean,
they're
just awful.
Yeah. So at one point, writer Brian Cogman says that, like, he wanted there to be this, like, deep ambiguity about Daenerys. And, you know, you do get, like, a line or two in the finale where, like, Jon says, like, are you sure we did the right thing? And Tyrion says, ask me again in 10 years. Like, okay, that's there, but, like, the camera is still framing, you know, Daenerys as standing in front of a Nuremberg rally, and they still put the Nymöller speech in Tyrion's mouth, and that kind of, like, symbolism only goes in one direction. So, you know, I feel like you need to, the, you know, part of my whole idea about season 8 being in reverse is that, like, there has to be a moral event horizon beyond which our protagonists do not go because they stop becoming protagonists. And, you know, there's no tragedy in the death of a tyrant. You know, John's tears aside, like, in that moment, yeah, of course she has to die. It's not really, you know, and you shouldn't feel that sad about it because the alternative is horror.
Right, and there won't be enough time. I mean, one would presume that there won't be enough time. Right, I mean, we have clear indications that George R. R. Martin kind of likes the idea of rehabilitating unrehabilitatable villains, right? And Jaime Lannister is sort of yeah, the great example.
Theon,
of this. But we have seven.
Greyjoy
we
as
have
well, yeah.
Theon Greyjoy, right? But we have seven books to rehabilitate these characters, right? And in both cases, it takes quite a bit of time
and quite a bit
of agony.
But yeah,
right. But the point is that they're not going to. If it were Danny to do something like this, half a book is not going to be sufficient.
It is redeem
that character.
It is interesting the sort of unintended consequences of having season 8 be a short season because, and that seemed to be something that was unusually within the prerogative of the showrunners because I think, you know, if you'd gone to HBO and said like, hey, you know, we think that Game of Thrones is going to run into 9 seasons, they would have been like, awesome, the money machine can keep printing. There wouldn't be any objection there, but that seemed to come much more from Benioff and Weiss, who I think kind of have one foot out the door into Star Wars land. You know, whereas like George R. R. Martin has talked about, like he's got, he thinks roughly 3,000 manuscript pages to go. That's a lot. A lot can happen in 3,000 manuscript pages. That, you know, you can have
and
time.
Those
for
are two 1,500 page
themselves.
Books, which seems. Yeah. I mean, that's like 5 books, but, yeah, no, that's a lot of work left to do.
Yeah. So, you know, the final thing that I'll say in sort of the difference of adaptation is I think at the end of the day, like if you look back through all 8 seasons of Game of Thrones, I do think that there's something of a difference in philosophy. Again, I think this sort of rounds out this idea of, deconstruction for what. Ultimately, George R. R. Martin is a romantic, not a nihilist. You know, he got his start writing Beauty and the Beast. He has a belief, I think, that, you know, you put the lows lower so that the highs can be higher. You know, that you have these sort of, you know, moments of horror, certainly, but they tend to be, you know, one thing that's interesting is, you know, they tend to be very much more signposted in the books than in the show. You know, if you think about the sort of the conventions of dramatic narrative, you know, there's always a huge amount of foreshadowing that sets up every kind of shocking event.
Right.
But he also has these moments of, you know, and this is an idea that I've sort of been elaborating on for several years now, of existential victory. That, like, he gives you these moments where characters stand up and do the right thing. And I think where the deconstruction comes in is that, you know, fantasy and, you know, I think this is something that comes out of its more medievalist heritage. Fantasy assumes that virtue will be rewarded. That, you know, if you do the right thing, the good guys will win in the end. And I think what Martin is getting at is that, you know, no, you don't always win. Virtue is not always rewarded, but it's still the choice to be virtuous is in itself a victory. So, you know, to me, this always starts with Cyrio Farrell deciding that he's going to, you know, go down swinging in this impossible battle because it means he saves the life of a child. And the choice to do that is his victory, whether or not he wins the fight. And, you know, there's all kind of moments that are in the books that we never really got in the show. There's this famous bit where, you know, Brienne is looking for Sansa and she's not finding Sansa. And she stumbles across this inn in where a bunch of children are being threatened by a whole sort of group of bandits, these real psychopaths. And she says to herself, like, there's no chance and no choice. Like, you know, unlike in the show where sort of plot armor and badassery will win you the day, she knows she can't win this fight, but she also knows that, like, she has no choice, you know, moral choice, but to go ahead and do it anyway. And her victory is in, you know, deciding to remain true to her principles. Whereas I think the show always had a far more sort of cynical understanding of political power and personal choices, where, you know, people who act honorably are ultimately seen as stupid. And there was this weird, you know, theory that the show seemed to really buy into, that in order to be good, you had to be stupid. And in order to be smart, you had to be a little bit evil. And I think that's where the you know, the book and the show don't really see eye to eye.
Right, right, right. And this plays off where even in by the final season, even you know, in the post episode interviews, right, people are just openly talking about Jon Snow as just not being a very bright character, right? Which is, whereas, I mean, we really do get to see, like, through the books, right? I mean, that he's calculating. He can be calculating, right?
Yeah.
And he can be ruthless as a character, right? Which is not to say that he's presented as sort of the most complicated strategist, but certainly more so than we see in the show. I want to take this another direction that we hadn't really planned, but talking about this has now made me think about it. Because my last question was going to be, you know, sort of what does this depiction offer us as the future of sort of high fantasy on screen, right?
Mm.
And right, if we think about sort of the Lord of the Rings and the unfortunate Hobbit trilogy as thesis, and Game of Thrones as antithesis.
What's synthesis? Yeah.
Right. Well, and then sort of it occurs to me, right? I mean, we may actually see that very, very soon, right? Because we're getting the new Middle Earth series that's going to be, I believe, focused on the Second Age. I mean, you may know a little bit more about what the adaptation is going for.
So there's
which is really interesting to see whether we're going to see this depiction bleed into a depiction of Tolkien's world.
Yeah, so there's a really interesting article on Polygon by Maureen Ryan titled How Hollywood's Hunt for the Next Game of Thrones Could Change Television. And, you know, in this article, she points out that, like, yeah, you know, the Lord of the Rings TV show was, like, design specific, like Jeff Bezos literally said, I want the next Game of Thrones. Give me the next Game of Thrones. And there are a whole bunch of shows coming out. There, you know, HBO is, you know, trying to stake its territory with not only these sort of Game of Thrones prequel spinoffs, God knows if those will work, but it's also going, you know, heavy into his Dark Materials, this sort of other, you know, big hit fantasy trilogy with, like, a truly astonishing cast, if you've seen that list. You know, there's also Amazon is also adapting the Dark Tower series, trying to pull off the Stephen King adaptation that the movie failed to do. There's an adaptation of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time.
That's
Netflix,
even longer. That's 14 books, right? How can they even manage Wheel of Time?
Yeah, Netflix is going in on The Witcher. They're adapting that really popular series, although that's a kind of an interesting case where a video game adaptation has proven more popular than the novels. Showtime is developing Patrick Rothfuss' Kingkiller Chronicles. So, you know, in some ways, I think we're going to be... Oh, and Apple is doing Isaac Asimov's Foundation. So... You know, I think we're going to be seeing, like, an explosion of genre television in a big way because of, you know, what Game of Thrones did. But I think, like, in terms of, you know, like, philosophy, I don't think it's going to be entirely Game of Thrones, because all of these series come with really, you know, unique and divergent philosophies. I mean, the sort of... atheism of his Dark Materials, you know, the sort of noir stylings of The Witcher, the kind of much more conventional epic fantasy of Lord of the Rings and King Color Chronicles, like, I think we're going to see a really kind of interesting mix of philosophies.
Well, Steve, I think that we are pretty much at the end of our time for today if we want to maintain a conventionally sized podcast. So thank you so much for joining us, and for our readers out there, thank you for joining us. And our hope, as ever, is to record more of these in a more timely fashion. And so, Steve, I'm sure you can join me in that hope.
Indeed.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, and we will talk again soon.
Bye.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find good music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through a PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.